Lapdog are ridiculous. Who wants to cuddle a 100-pound dragon, for goodness sake? His mournful whimpering for attention is most unwyvern-like. Occasionally, I catch him eyeing the bird with a hungry look and remind him that he is the one who chose to be a domestic creature and therefore must not give way to his wild urges. Amusing ravens and envious wyverns aside, I am worried. Worried because it is now the second week of March and Scarf and O'Neill have not yet rattled and clanged their way to our gate. But more worried because I am certain that my sister is shrinking. Auntie sees it too, I know. Although she has not said a word about it, I have watched Auntie run her gaze along the length of our mermaid girl, shaking her head and clucking her tongue. Auntie lifts one of Marin's hands and kisses her pale, glittery skin. Marin stirs, but keeps her mother-of-pearl-colored eyelids closed. Auntie's brow furrows with concern and sorrow. She sprinkles a teacup full of salt into the tub and stirs it with her hand, swirling the warm water and causing Marin's floating locks to tangle. My sister is no longer human. From her coppery hair to the end of her glorious, iridescent tail, Marin is a mermaid. She is beautiful in a way that no mere human could ever be. The only remnants of humanness she retains are O'Neill's locket, which she refuses to remove, and the shawl that covers her breasts. I will not ask, how long can she survive this way, or is she truly growing smaller each day? I fear Auntie's utterly honest answers, and in my heart of hearts, I know what they would be. Osbert nuzzles my leg with his snout, and I scratch him between his pointy ears. He could live 500 more years. He could grow bigger than the cottage and boast teeth as tall as O'Neill. But he will never forget any of this. Wyverns never forget a thing. Not even silly pet wyverns like our Osbert. Suddenly, he lifts his head and perks his ears. His wings twitch, and his tail slaps the hardwood floor. With a hearty howl, he dashes into the kitchen and berates the door for being shut. In between his complaints and barks, I hear the faint sound of pots and pans banging together, the tinkle of many wind chimes. My heart races so that I can barely catch my breath. Auntie is on her feet before I can persuade my own feet to move. Happy tears stream over her plump cheeks as she gives me a gentle shove. "Go on, girl," she says. "Hurry out and welcome the wanderers home. Thank heavens the winter is finally over." Osbert and I race to the wagon with Pilsner soaring above us. As soon as O'Neill's boots meet the ground, I throw myself into his arms.
"Well," he says, "I did not expect such a welcome from you, my well-mannered lass."
Thank you," I say into his shoulder, breathing in that O'Neill scent I have missed. Spices and strong soap, sun-dried clothes and happiness. I feel rescued and hopeful and in love.
"I thought you'd never come."
He pats my back.
"Ah, but I always do, don't I? As surely as the spring, Scarf and I always return to our girls."
I step out of his embrace, still clutching the fabric of his colorful vest, and I look into his face. It was silly of me to think otherwise. I blush like Mr. Peterman's awkward son and let go of his clothes.
"You're even prettier than the last time I saw you, Miss Clara,"
he teases.
"And you've grown taller, haven't you? Has Scarf been forced to buy you new trousers again?"
O'Neill holds out a leg.
"He gave me his old boots instead. Says people won't notice how short my trousers are if my boots go to my knees."
Scarf and Auntie face one another, holding hands. She is fussing over his gauntness, the hollows in his cheeks, the thinness of his pale wrists, how his beard needs trimming and his jacket needs mending. He smiles like a leprechaun beholding an overflowing pot of gold.
"Take me to Marin," O'Neill says, tugging me along by the hand.
"You will not like what you see.
I warn as we cross the threshold into the kitchen.
She is quite changed, O'Neill.
Madame Vadoma's receipt did not work?
It helped a little. Have you brought nothing else for her? A charm or another receipt?
He shakes his head.
The gypsies had nothing else to offer. I'm sorry.
From the doorway of the bedroom, the back of Marin's gold-speckled hair is just visible above the edge of the tub. He releases my hand and approaches her slowly, each step noiseless. When he rounds the tub and sees her fully, all color drains from his face.
O'Neill,
she mouths, her voice all but gone. Joy expands across her features, making her skin sparkle even more than usual.
Oh, love,
he whispers. He falls to his knees and reaches for her, cupping her cheek in his palm.
Look at you.
Marin lifts her silvery green fin from the water without any indication of regretting its presence. In fact, she seems proud of her strange appendage.
Beautiful,
she mouths. O'Neill stares at her in wide-eyed wonder.
Does it hurt? Are you in pain, dearest?
She shakes her pretty head and motions with her hands. She touches her heart, then points outward, then pantomimes the waves of the ocean.
She longs for the ocean, I translate. She's been losing her voice.
But I do not think he hears me. Every bit of his attention is directed toward Marin, and I cannot mistake the presence of pure love in his gaze and his gestures. How I hate myself in this moment. I hate that I am jealous of his undisguised devotion. I hate that I love him and that he does not return my love. I hate that I can so easily think of myself and my desires when my sister is in danger of dying. I leave the room. What is between them is not meant for spectators.
I wish, above all things, that none of this had ever happened.
Grateful that Scarf and O'Neill have brought sunshine with them, we throw open all the doors and windows to let in the warm air and the sounds of birds rejoicing. Auntie bustles about, gathering ingredients and supplies to prepare a celebratory feast. At Auntie's command, I stir and knead, baste and slice, chop and arrange. She alternately hums and fusses over the food. Will there be enough applesauce? Are those carrots cut thinly enough? Does O'Neill still hate cabbage? Scarf and O'Neill are entertaining Marin. For once, she is wide awake and able to enjoy herself. Scarf's terrible jokes follow close upon O'Neill's fervent ballad singing, slightly off-key, but still moving. Scarf's deep voice echoes through the cottage as he tells outrageous tales of his youth, which may or may not be true. When the air is saturated with the scents of ham and fresh bread rolls, candied carrots and apple pie, and once the perfect sprig of parsley is plucked from its pot on the windowsill and placed atop the steaming platter of potatoes, Scarf and O'Neill drag Marin's tub into the kitchen, mermaid and all. She is given a view of the table and a cup of seaweed tea, for she no longer eats anything at all. Other than the bathtub in the kitchen, the celebration resembles every other return of Scarf and O'Neill party we have ever had. Stories, overeating, and fond glances are exchanged. Finally, Scarf stands and raises his glass of elderberry wine.
A toast to the present company,
he declares. We clink glasses and take sips, despite our full bellies.
Now, an announcement.
Marin claps her hands. Water droplets splash into the fireplace, hissing as they evaporate.
For many long years has this wonderful creature been the very heart of my heart.
He begins. He looks at Auntie as if they were both 17 and stricken with first love.
Do sit down, Auntie says, and try not to embellish things too much.
With a harumph, Scarf settles into his chair beside Auntie. He takes her hand in his and rests them upon the table.
Shall I start at the very beginning, my love?
Auntie nods, eyes twinkling.
Scarf leans back in his chair.
If I were to tell you how long ago this tale begins, you would doubt the entire telling of it. So I will use the traditional beginning. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful young maiden.
Auntie rolls her eyes heavenward.
Tis true, Scarf insists. No ordinary girl was she. It was said that her mother was of full fairy blood, and her father was a warrior prince of a far northern land. But she was placed in the care of a pair of spinster ladies. They raised her in a rambling red brick mansion beside a blue lake. They taught her manners and dancing, and how to sew a fine seam. What they did not teach her, what she already knew in her half-fairy bones, were the names and uses of every herb and plant in the forest. Why, without any lessons or books, the lass could make up medicines to cure almost anything. And when the spinster ladies, the first Wangler sisters they were called, Inga and Hilma, when they realized the depths of their adopted daughter's unusual talents, they sent her to be apprenticed to a healer woman in Bremen by the name of Frau Albruna. Some said Albruna was a witch, but I'd never call her such. She did not like the word, and crossing her never did anyone a lick of good. Well, our girl, who came to Albruna with the unlikely name of Veritude, had a mind like a thirsty sponge, and before long she'd soaked up all Albruna had to teach. After that, young Fräulein Verity taught Albruna a thing or two.
Scarf pauses to sip his wine and wink at Auntie.
Enough flirting,
O'Neill scolds.
Get on with the story, old man. Yes, well, where was I? Oh, yes, Bremen. I was a strapping lad then, you see, 16, and just back from a year at sea. I'd seen such things on that ship. Six-headed sea monsters that would give your Osbert nightmares. Squid, bigger than the ship itself. And even mermaids, though none as lovely as our Merin.
Merin blows him a kiss. He pretends to catch and pocket it. Scarf clears his throat and continues.
I was feeling poorly, so my grandmother sent me to Albruna's place on Autostrasse. Now, as world-traveled as I was, my first sight of Albruna gave me a fright. The tallest woman I'd ever laid eyes on, broad-shouldered as the most strapping seaman, wild-haired as Medusa, with eyes like two spheres of polished coal of fire. I trembled in my boots. My mouth went dry, and my pulse roared in my ears. Ready to die standing up, I was. And then a sweet voice came from behind the dreadful woman, saying, "Who is it?" Like music, those three words. A second later, a face peered around the dreadful Albruna, and my poor heart stopped, just stopped.
Auntie grins. It stopped, and he fell like a sapling before a woodsman's axe. Flat onto Albruna's enormous feet, squashing her new doeskin slippers. Scarf's chuckle rumbles like far-off thunder.
When I awoke, there was that beautiful face peering into mine. My heart was beating right as rain, but it no longer belonged to me, and never would again.
Auntie chimes in, and I felt the same. From the moment I saw the scrawny blonde boy all a quiver on Albruna's doorstep, Albruna knew it too. She never said a word about it. But after we'd dosed our patient with tonics and tisanes for 3 days and nights, and the color had returned to his cheeks, she handed me a satchel holding all my earthly goods, placed a gold ring in Scarf's hand, and shooed us out the door as if we were a pair of trespassing chickens. I looked back from the street to see her wipe away a tear, and we waved goodbye to one another. I never saw her again. Scarf lifts Auntie's hand to his lips and kisses her knuckles tenderly.
Before we took to the roads, we visited the old priest. Poor Father Matthias, as ancient and holy as he was, He greatly feared Albruna and her pupil, and so did not refuse to marry us, even though it was midnight, with only a pigeon in the chapel rafters as witness. Afterward, he gave us woolen blankets and a lantern, and the room above his stables for the night.
Married? I exclaim in wonder and delight. All this time?
You rascal, O'Neill says, poking Scarf in the shoulder. Keeping such secrets from your own son.
Wait, I say. Why have you not lived together? Why have we not all lived together? What fun we could have had.
If I could continue without you children interrupting, perhaps you might learn the answers to your questions.
His tone is serious, but his blue eyes merry.
Do go on, forgiving us our rudeness, O'Neill says with false penitence. We wandered for years, my bride and I. I did odd jobs in the towns we visited, and Verity, no longer Veritude, since I changed her name on our wedding night. Verity earned coins aplenty healing the sick. A happier couple there never was. We had each other, a fine tent, a cooking pot, and all the world before us.
Until, offers O'Neill. Caressing his fluffy beard thoughtfully, Scarf continues.
Until, my boy, until Verity and I took a notion to see the new world. The ships bobbing in the ocean in an English port sparked in her a longing to sail the seas. Remembering my seafaring youth more fondly than I should have, I agreed. Besides, I could deny the enchantress nothing. She might have slipped me a potion and made me into a hairy toad.
Scarf's wife. What a grand thing for Auntie to be Scarf's own wife. Slaps his arm playfully. If only I could, you old buffoon.
Silliness aside, he says, the crossing proved a nightmare. Half the passengers perished of a fever, and a third of the crew as well. Verity nursed as many as she could, using up the box of herbs she'd brought and much of the captain's own supply. Yet each morning brought the sounding of the ship's bell and splash after splash of shrouded bodies slipping into the sea. And days from America, the sickness ceased. For all but my wife, that is.
He stops speaking and squeezes Auntie's hand. O'Neill, ever the tease, says nothing. Marin rests her head against the back of the tub. Even Osbert and Pilsner seem to hold their breath in anticipation of Scarf's next words. Finally, quietly, he continues.
My Verity fought the fever, tooth and nail, and lived. But the child she bore did not. So tiny she was, our daughter. Verity named her Violet and wrapped her in a length of snow-white silk. The sailors wept as the waves carried her little body away. We were all so heartsick that not one person cheered when we dropped anchor in Boston the following morning.
Your only child, I whisper. Our first child, my dear, Auntie says. The seashell, stork, and the apple tree gave us three more. Standing and stretching like a bear fresh from hibernation, Scarf says,
It's late. I believe the rest of the story can wait until tomorrow.
O'Neill and I groan in unison. O'Neill says,
You didn't explain why you've lived apart. You can't leave us wondering. I can and I will,
Scarf says with authority.
Now, O'Neill, my boy, hurry and fetch your things from the caravan. Tonight, my darling wife will occupy your place in the bed. You may sleep in the kitchen or the barn, your choice.
Like a new bride, Auntie blushes. So do I.
For heaven's sake,
O'Neill grumbles. But he is smiling widely, looking just as happy as the old married couple. Or almost. After the couple departs, O'Neill helps me replenish the warm water in Marin's tub. Next, I wash Marin's face and hands. It is silly, I know.
She lives in clean water from the mountain springs and does nothing to become dirty. But we have always washed our faces together at bedtime. If we cannot share our bed anymore, cannot whisper secrets from our pillows or hold hands after nightmares, at least I can preserve a small piece of our former routine. She is fast asleep before I finish dabbing the water from her alabaster cheeks. It would be pointless to move the tub back into the bedroom now. Osbert promises, with a nod of his head, to alert me if she needs anything during the night.
That's done, then, O'Neill says as he places the last refilled kettle onto the stove. I'll soon be off to the barn to share the hay with Zedekiah.
He turns toward me, his expression strange and wistful. For a moment, I think he might sweep me into his arms and kiss me. But no, his gaze is on the sleeping mermaid. His tender, loving gaze. I drop my towel onto the table and hasten toward the bedroom. Good night, I say without looking back.
You don't want to stay up and talk, like we always do? Come on, Clara, it is not even midnight.
I am tired, I say. I close the door behind me and dive onto the bed, burying my anguish in the depths of my feather pillow. I hate myself. I hate O'Neill. I hate everything in the world, but mostly myself. I dream. My wings are long and white, with tips of black as if the feathers had brushed along a sea of ink. On ocean winds, I soar and circle. I angle my elegant red bill downwards and dive toward the water. A coppery head breaks through the top of a wave, and then the pale-skinned torso of a young woman, Marin. She reaches above her head with both arms and flips over into the churning ocean, her iridescent fishtail catching the sunlight before she disappears beneath the surf. My bill opens, but I cannot speak. No matter how I try, I can only make an ugly clattering sound. I dive after Marin, and the water swallows me up like a huge, toothless beast consuming its prey. I awaken, my heart heavy. Is this prophecy, this strange dream? Will I truly be a stork, as Marin is a mermaid? Could it be confirmation of what I have long expected but attempted to ignore? The truth is, in spite of all my attempts to ignore it, Marin has shown mermaid-like peculiarities since infancy. A love of water and a taste for salt, the uncanny ability to swim as deftly as a dolphin before she could even speak. But I am nothing like a stork. I haven't the slightest affinity for eating frogs and minnows and have never longed to fly. My legs are not long, and I am far from graceful. There. I tell myself, I have examined the evidence and found good reason to declare that I will not become a stork. Then again, as Auntie has said, what I choose to believe does not change what is true. I sigh with exasperation and roll onto what used to be Marin's side of the bed. Through the window, the moon shines serenely. Its position in the sky tells me that dawn is many hours away. And so I count the stars, one by one, until somehow I drift off to sleep again. Chapter 11. A red sunrise stains the bedroom's lace curtains pink. I dress quickly, anxious to check on Marin. She is my first thought each day, even before I open my eyes. I do not think that I will ever grow accustomed to her sleeping in another room. Or another realm, for that matter. So I go to her. And there, curled up beside the bathtub in a plaid blanket, is O'Neill. His hair sticks up like a field of wind-blown hay, and he is snoring almost as loudly as Osbert. But to me, he is beautiful. I pinch my arm hard, punishing myself for my continued foolishness, for feeling so unsisterly toward my almost brother, for being stupid enough to think he could ever choose me over Marin. My brown hair and eyes and regular features are perfectly unremarkable. She was always the pretty and charming one, and now in her mermaid state she is glorious beyond words. What man could resist? Indeed, aren't mermaids supposed to be irresistible, capable of luring sailors to their deaths? On my way to the stove, I bump into a chair. Its legs squeal as they scrape against the floor.
Good morning,
O'Neill says, his voice thick with sleep.
You are up with the chickens.
Too cold in the barn? Bitterness coats my words.
Zedekiah was hogging the blankets. Are you angry with me? Was it terribly improper for me to sleep in the house?
Of course it was, I blurt, and lying beside my sister. Just because she is a mermaid does not mean she should be treated like a harlot. I keep my face toward the window.
I'm truly sorry,
he says.
I did not think of that.
I let my emotions simmer for a moment, and then I take a deep breath. I'm sorry, too, I say gently. I should not have spoken to you like that.
Friends,
he says. He is standing behind me now. The spicy Christmas scent of him still makes me woozy, no matter how I fight it. Of course, I say, pasting a smile on my face and turning around. You are my almost brother, after all. Water whooshes and splashes against the inside of the tub as Marin stirs, attracting all our attention to the mermaid girl. O'Neill runs a hand through his hair, his habit when perplexed or troubled. He motions for me to follow him across the room where Marin may not hear our whispers.
She is smaller than she was yesterday. I'm sure of it,
he says. I nod, every day, by fractions.
What will become of her?
I think she must be taken to the ocean, or she will shrink away to nothing. She will disappear.
We must take her then.
His eyes meet mine.
You and I must take her to the ocean. Scarf is not well enough, no matter what he might say. He needs to stay here with Auntie and her potions and recover his strength.
I know then, without a doubt, that he is as brave as the heroic O'Neill of my daydreams, braver than I could ever hope to be myself. I will go with you, I say. I would follow you to the ends of the earth, I think. And then I look at the mermaid across the room. I would do anything to save my sister.
As would I,
he says. He takes both my hands and squeezes them tightly.
We will make the journey together. And once there, we will find a way to save her, Clara. Surely the merfolk can tell us how to release her from whatever enchantment has stolen her humanity.
The mermaid slaps her tail against the water. She points and gestures demandingly. Have patience, sister dear. I was just getting to that, I reply. Fetch the buckets, O'Neill. Her highness requires fresh, warm water. He bows low with a flourish of his hand.
Queen Marin. Your subjects shall obey.
She peers into O'Neill's face worshipfully as he scoops the old water from the tub to make room for the new. He meets her gaze and endows her with one of his mischievous, crooked grins before dousing her with the bucket's contents. She giggles, sea foam rolling over sand, and grabs his wrist and pulls. Only narrowly does he escape tumbling into the tub. Marin's full-on laughter is a bubbling, sub-aquatic spring. Everything about her glistens. Her skin, her copper-gold hair, the lustrous scales of her perfect tail. Even her eyes gleam. She is happy. My sister, Marin, is happy as a mermaid. And she is happier still with O'Neill at her side. She has not shed a single pearl tear since his return to the mountain. The knowledge stabs me like a knife. She is happy, and I must let her go. I realize that I must stop trying to make her into the girl she was, now that she is the mermaid she was born to be. As Auntie has said, we must be who we truly are. The knife plunges deeper as I realize how completely Marin loves O'Neill. Nothing but love could make a person, or a mermaid, glow in such a way. It is the most beautiful and terrible thing I have ever beheld. Beautiful, as all true love is. Terrible, because the thing I feel for O'Neill is paltry, dull, and silly in comparison. From this moment on, I swear to banish my unsisterly feelings for O'Neill. It is a hollow promise I make to myself. One that I fear I shall break 1,000 times before learning how to keep it. I will do my best to let go of both of them, the mermaid and her true love. They will be who they must be. Who am I to interfere with that? I pity him, truly I do. His time with her is short. For what place could there be in the ocean for a human peddler boy, other than as food for a shark? Heaven forbid such a thing. O'Neill nudges me.
What is it?
Nothing, I lie. He must arrive at his moment of truth and surrender on his own. I have known him since we were infants, and I know he would not accept such a painful truth from me. His bright, unquenchable hopefulness is one of the things that makes him who he is, one of the things that makes me, made me, love him. Only brutal experience and unchangeable, visible facts could ever make him give up on making Marin human again. When Marin reaches her ocean home and leaves him on the shore, what will become of him? A spring snowstorm shuts us all inside the cozy cottage. The fire blazes as the wind howls, and O'Neill sings a naughty sea chanty that makes even our mermaid blush.
"Craw!"
says Pilsner, shaking his head in what I take to be approval of the unsavory lyrics. The impish bird perches at the foot of Marin's tub and preens his blue-black plumage.
"Enough of the wholesome entertainment,"
Scarf says, setting his penny whistle aside and scratching Osbert behind the ears.
"I owe you children the rest of the tale I began a few days ago."
We pull our chairs closer to Marin, forming a semicircle around the tub. Marin snatches O'Neill's hand and bats her shimmering eyelashes. The mermaid version of my sister is even more flirtatious than the human girl was. Then again, no village lad could hope to compare to our O'Neill.
"Where were we? Boston, was it? Just off the ship, trying to get our land legs back. Yes, that was where we left off. So, Verity and I set out upon the road, living much as we had back in the old country. A penny here, a fresh loaf there. But the cold in America proved much more biting than any we had known before. As luck would have it, we met up with a little old man by the name of Willie Brady. A traveling tinker he was, bereft because his partner had recently succumbed to consumption. At the end of his rope, he said he was, about to dig a hole and bury himself, if only he could figure out how. But didn't our Verity talk sense into Willie Brady? And in two shakes of a lamb's tail, we were on the road together, selling pots and pans and spoons and the like, as well as Verity's cough elixirs and headache powders. A grand time it was. At night we'd light a nice fire in the caravan's little potbelly stove, and we'd bed down as warm as fleas on a spaniel.
Willie Brady was like a father to us. A kinder man you'll never meet, Auntie adds.
Come spring, we rolled into Pennsylvania. Or, rather, we bumped and bounced. The roads were terrible then, and only got worse with the thaw. The mud would swallow your shoes whole and never give them back. One day, that evil mud took hold of Brady's favorite horse's leg and snapped it like kindling. How he wept over that horse. The loss of her broke his heart, and he dwindled down to a bone and a hank of hair after that. On Midsummer's Eve, he breathed his last. We buried him at twilight, at the edge of a field flashing with fireflies.
Marin sighs and slips a bit further into the water, taking O'Neill's hand with her. His sleeve wicks water up to his elbow, but he does not complain. Scarf coughs into his handkerchief.
Yes, I miss the old fellow to this day. Lucky he was. I am certain of that, for after he died, bad luck took hold of us without delay. Less than 20 miles from here, it happened. And Verity has never been able to set foot off this mountain since.
He is overcome by a fit of coughing. Auntie passes him a green bottle. Time for your medicine, dear, she says. I will finish this story, if you please. Scarf nods in assent and gulps down the dark liquid. We came into Yardley Corner, a tiny town at the base of Lanfair Mountain. Not a trace of it remains today. The forest has reclaimed every inch of soil and stone. Well, in this town there lived a half-fairy woman, 200 years old or more. She recognized me on sight as one of her kind, and she hated me for it. No matter that we were only passing through, only selling coffee elixir and sewing needles and such. I discerned by the atmosphere about her that she possessed proficiency in the dark arts, potent black magic that Albruna had forbidden me to learn. This witch woman took it into her mind that I was her greatest enemy, trespassing on her territory. She was the healer on this mountain, she said, but if I wanted her place, I could have it. I wanted to settle there as much as I wanted to grow a third arm, and I told her so. She called me a liar, and before I knew what was happening, she threw a powerful hex powder over me and Scarf, saying, To this mountain you are bound, Verity Half-Fay, never to leave it till death claims you. And from this mountain you are banned, Ezra Scarf, but for 13 days a year, until the Dark Horse and Raven return, and the 3 rubies of the Gypsy King fall into your wife's hand, and your last golden hair turns as silver as the moon. She thought she was being quite generous, giving us 13 days a year together, the hag. Zedekiah and Pilsner, I say. The Dark Horse and Raven. And you have the rubies, Auntie? She reaches into her pocket and brings forth a velvet box. They're here. The Gypsy King himself gave them to Scarf, said he'd been told to do so in a dream.
And Scarf's winter fever turned his last golden hair silver,
O'Neill says.
How many years has it been since the hex bound you?
Auntie caresses Scarf's bearded cheek. We lost count long ago. What does it matter? We are together now.
And I may come and go as I please,
Scarf says.
Not that I plan to leave my bride any time soon. Indeed, I do believe I will choose to go only as far as bed.
He coughs again. Indeed, Auntie says. Come along now. You'll find my bed 100 times more comfortable than that lumpy old mattress you keep in the caravan.
Nonsense, woman,
Scarf grumbles.
That mattress was good enough for Willie Brady, and it's good enough for me.
He laughs and coughs at the same time as Auntie wraps an arm about his shoulders and steers him toward her bedroom. Don't stay up too late, dears, Auntie calls back to us. Of course. Merrin is already asleep. Lately, she sleeps most of the day away, and all of the night. I miss her. Quietly, with practiced ease, O'Neill and I refresh the tub's water. And as I put another log on the fire, he unrolls his blankets along the far wall of the kitchen, as far away from Merrin as he could get without going outdoors. Osbert scampers to his side and turns about 3 times before settling down with his barbed tail over O'Neill's legs and his snout upon O'Neill's chest. Good night, O'Neill and I whisper. I crawl into the bed Merrin and I used to share. The chilly sheets make me shiver. It occurs to me that I am the only one sleeping alone. for Pilsner perches beside Marin. Auntie and Scarf are snuggled up in the next room, and O'Neill and Osbert are cuddling in the kitchen. I wonder if I should ask Zedekiah to keep me company. But remember that O'Neill called the horse a blanket hog. And on such a frigid night, I'd rather keep my blankets. Chapter 12. It is 2 days after Easter. O'Neill grips the reins as the colorful caravan jostles down the hole-pocked road toward Llanfair Village. Every bump knocks my shoulder against his and causes my pencil to jump. This list will be completely unreadable, I say.
Did you put down salt? We will need a lot of it to keep our mermaid happy on our travels.
O'Neill grips the reins more tightly as the caravan rolls over a series of potholes.
Easy, Job! Easy, January!
He shouts to be heard over the din of wind chimes and pots and pans colliding as they swing from their hooks beneath the eaves.
Salt, yes. Do you think 10 pounds is enough? Perhaps I should buy 20 or 30.
And I promised Osbert a sack of licorice lozenges,
O'Neill says guiltily.
Good heavens, O'Neill. That wyvern needs licorice like he needs another tail. It makes him giddy, you know. You'll be forced to play fetch the stick with him for a full day and night after he gulps it down.
Spoken like a true wyvern's mother.
His lopsided smile appears. I must remind myself that he is nothing more than my almost brother, no matter how handsome he might be. This from the young man who snuggles up with the wyvern each night. Will you two be getting married this June by any chance? He jabbed his elbow into my arm.
If you were a boy, I'd fight you for such an insult.
To defend your beloved wyvern's honor?
You have wounded me.
He clutches his chest. The horses mistake his tugging of the reins for a command, and they slow down.
Trot, my beauties,
he calls to them.
Now back to the list. It's a long journey we're in for. We must not forget anything. Let's think on it.
After a few minutes, I lose focus on the list and begin to worry. When I can contain my anxieties no longer, I ask, how long will it take to reach the ocean?
2 or 3 weeks, depending on the roads and the weather.
I hope Marin will last that long. She is so small now that she can almost swim in the bathtub, I say. I pick a pine needle from my skirt and toss it to the wind.
Job and January will do their best to carry us there speedily. They have sworn a solemn oath to me.
The horses whinny as if in agreement. O'Neill winks at me like a storybook scoundrel.
Can you not be serious for 5 minutes, O'Neill?
Suddenly, I am weary to the soul.
You think I am teasing? You don't believe that animals communicate with me?
He asks, sullen.
Of course I do. I know they do. That is not the issue. What drives me mad is that you carry on playing and winking when the situation calls for solemnity.
He fumbles with his cuff. I know that even despite my tirade, he is itching to do some parlor trick to lighten my mood.
I swear, O'Neill, if you pull a flower from your sleeve, I will jump off this wagon, I say.
Sorry,
he replies sadly. I have wounded him, and I deeply regret it.
No, I am sorry.
I touch his arm and he winces.
Perhaps I should take Marin to the ocean alone, then. If you cannot tolerate me. If you believe I am nothing but tricks and amusements without substance.
O'Neill, please forgive me, I beg. You know that you are my dearest friend, and I do love your tricks and illusions. It is just that I am so tired and confused. The world is not at all what I thought it was. There is more magic in it, and more mystery, and more pain.
He lets the reins slacken in his hands and turns his face to me. A smile lurks at the edges of his mouth.
I forgive you, Clara dear. And I hope that you will soon see that the world is also more beautiful than you had known, and more full of kindness and love. Perhaps on our journey, you will find this out for yourself. You will come with Marin and me, won't you?
Yes, I say, If you left me behind, I would send my dangerous wyvern after you. He would eat you for supper and bring me back your boots as a souvenir. My humor has returned, much to my surprise.
Ah,
he says, shaking the reins to hurry the horses now that we've reached level ground.
I am afraid you actually mean that.
Never cross a wyvern, I say. And never, ever cross one of Verity's daughters.
Wise advice,
he says with that crooked O'Neill grin, the one that brings the sunshine out from behind a clouded heart. The one, I must remind myself, that belongs to my sister's true love. But as the proverb goes, even a cat may look at a king. As O'Neill hitches the horses to the post in front of Norton's feed store, Mrs. Locke and Mrs. Grieg take notice of the caravan and scurry across the street, waving and yoo-hooing. As Scarf and O'Neill are wont to brag, such middle-aged housewives find their exotic wares irresistible. With the charisma of a stage actor and the skill of an experienced vendor, O'Neill throws open the doors and cabinets of the colorful wagon and begins to expound upon the incomparability of his merchandise. He is a whirlwind of charm and flurrying silk scarves, trays of silver rings, and boxes of Chinese fans. List in hand, I leave O'Neill to his work and seek out Mr. Peterman at the general store. While Mr. Peterman gathers the items we need, I wander about the store, hoping that browsing might help me remember anything I forgot to put on the list.
Hello, Miss Clara.
Simon's voice says from behind me. I turn to him. Good morning, Simon, I say. You are looking well.
I was married last Saturday, he says. Do you remember Tabitha Gorse?
Yes, I say. She moved to Iowa a few years ago, didn't she?
She moved back here in February, he says.
He shifts his weight from one foot to the other nervously. He clears his throat twice, then asks,
How is your sister?
Very changed, I am afraid.
I'm sorry,
he says.
Very sorry.
Is that a tear in his eye or a trick of the light? He turns away from me and takes a few slow steps. She liked your Christmas gift, I say. The pretty stone you sent. She keeps it in her locket, so it is always with her. I do not know if it was proper or kind for me to say so. But he looks back at me for a moment and almost smiles.
Goodbye,
he says. He leaves the store quickly, without purchasing a thing. I think he loves Marin still. I feel sorry for his wife.
Your order is ready,
Mr. Peterman announces.
I'll carry it out for you. All that salt makes for a heavy load. It's an odd time of year to be pickling and preserving, isn't it?
I hold the door for him. You know Auntie and her strange concoctions, I say. I am glad we will leave Lanfair Mountain soon. Hiding a mermaid is proving more difficult than hiding a 100-pound pet wyvern. We reveal our plans to Scarf and Auntie during our habitual evening gathering in front of the fireplace.
You must let me come, Scarf says. I insist upon it.
No, dear, Auntie says. The children are right. You are not well enough for such a journey. Besides, I have not been left alone in over 17 years. It is your spousal duty to stay with me. She pats his arm. This is their journey to take. They are young and strong and clever as well. They are fit for travel and adventure, unlike us. Although it pains me to think I will not see Marin enter her new home. Scarf grumbles under his breath, but argues no more.
We will leave in 2 days, O'Neill says. I will make sure the caravan is in good repair. Clara has been gathering supplies, and Marin is quite ready to go.
In fact, Marin's face is radiant with expectation. She wriggles her tail and slides down into the water, submerging herself completely. Smiling, she blows a string of tiny bubbles and watches them pop above her. From head to tail fin, I doubt she measures more than 4 feet now. We bought a wash tub to carry Marin, I say. It should be quite comfortable.
You must avoid the trains at all cost, Scarf says. I do not trust the iron beasts.
We would not risk taking a train, O'Neill says. Can you imagine us not being noticed transporting a mermaid in a tub of water?
Scarf grunts and folds his arms across his chest. Auntie shakes her head sadly.
How I hate to lose my seashell girl, she says. But if anyone in the world is happy, it is Merin as a mermaid.
Tears stick in Scarf's beard like drops of dew on tangled grass. Auntie grips his shoulder and says,
Come to bed, dearest. It's time to put our cares to rest for the day.
Auntie and Scarf lean over the tub, and Merin comes out from beneath the water, offering her sparkling cheek for goodnight kisses. As the couple disappears into their bedroom, Merin beckons to O'Neill. She gestures that she wants to hold his hand, and that she wants him to sing for her. He pulls a chair in close to the tub and does as the mermaid demands. Discomfited by the intimacy between them, I collect teacups and saucers and take them to the basin of sudsy water Auntie left heating on the side of the stove. Even with my back to them, I feel like an intruder. O'Neill sings softly, On the wings of the wind, o'er the dark rolling deep, angels are coming to watch o'er thy sleep. Angels are coming to watch over thee, so list to the wind coming over the sea. Hear the wind blow, love, hear the wind blow. Lean your head over and hear the wind blow. O winds of the night, may your fury be crossed. May no one who's dear to our island be lost. Blow the winds gently, calm be the foam. Shine the light brightly and guide them back home. Hear the wind blow, love, hear the wind blow. Lean your head over and hear the wind blow. My hands forget their task. Never has his voice sounded so beautiful. Every note carries unconstrained love up from the depths of his soul. Something catches my eye and I turn. There, at the window, is the unmistakable face of Simon Shumsky. He stares at Merin and O'Neill, not noticing me at all. He sees what I now see. The clasped hands of lovers, O'Neill's blonde head resting against the top of Merin's coppery hair, and the swishing of Merin's mermaid tail above the water's surface.
O'Neill!
I cry, knowing it is too late. A second later, Simon is gone. If wishing could get me anything, I would wish that I had remembered to close the curtains after I'd hung them, freshly laundered, that morning. I would wish that Osbert, lying by the cellar door, dead to the world due to the strong medicine Auntie has prescribed for his spring cold, would have alerted us of the unwelcome guest. And as much as I like Simon Shumsky, I would wish him to the moon. Chapter 13. The sun is rising, an orange ball of flame peeking over the next mountain. We have not slept a wink, O'Neill and I. Instead, we spent the night frantically packing and arranging, gathering maps and clothes and food, for we must leave the mountain immediately, before Simon has a chance to spread the news of Merin's change. Once we are gone from the mountain, Scarf will make it known in the village that O'Neill, Merin, and I have gone to visit far-off relations. Scarf is able to speak falsely for our protection, even if Auntie cannot. And Simon will likely be labeled touched in the head if he goes about telling tales of seeing a mermaid in Verity Amsel's kitchen. Auntie weeps into her handkerchief as Scarf lifts Merin from the bath and lowers her into the washtub. Osbert moans and smacks his tail against the floor like a toddler throwing a fit. Pilsner watches from the mantel, the only calm soul among us. Scarf and O'Neill pick up the washtub by its handles and carry it to the caravan, sloshing a good third of the water out as they go. Merin grips the sides of the tub to steady herself.
She looks like a picture from one of our childhood books, one captioned, "An Indian princess travels to her wedding by howdah atop an elephant." Indeed, her face is as bright with bliss as any bride's. She is glad to be going home.
"Promise you'll come back,"
Auntie says as she embraces me beside the wagon.
"Of course,"
I say. I swallow hard, willing myself not to cry. I will keep my sadness to myself and not add to the weight of Auntie's sorrow.
"Take care of Scarf."
And before our lazy rooster crows, O'Neill is shaking the reins and steering Job and January away from the only home my sister and I have ever known. I sit inside the caravan beside Marin. Only her head extends above the oilcloth covering the washtub. Scarf tied the cloth down tight before we left, to keep the water and the mermaid from sloshing out. I worry that the rough roads will batter and bruise her. Perhaps we should have brought the bathtub. It would have given her more of a watery cushion. It is too late now. The little window is open so that O'Neill may speak to us from the driver's seat. The clopping of the horse's hooves is barely audible above the sound of the pots, pans, and chimes. I wonder if O'Neill ever tires of those sounds. To me, they have always signaled the approach of joy itself, heralding the arrival of loved ones. What might they mean to me when this journey is finished and I have given Marin over to the tides? She sleeps, my mermaid sister. Sleeps with a smile on her coral pink lips, swaying with the motion of the wagon, as if she has not a care in the world. Not one regret. Not a single sorrow. Not an ounce of pain. A snort comes from beneath a mound of blankets in the corner. A very familiar snort.
"Osbert!" I scold him as I whisk away his coverings. "You naughty wyvern! You should not have come along!"